It's Tuesday, February 3rd, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Steve Davis, sitting with Wayne Wachowski, and we're about to collect an oral history from Edward Wachowski.
Edward Wachowski.
Yes. Mr. Wachowski, I want to thank you for allowing us to do this. First question I had was, when and where were you born?
I was born in Gary, Indiana, March 6th. 1924.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
None.
An only child?
An only child.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
They both were factory workers, steel factory workers.
Were they born in the U.S.?
No.
Where were they born?
Poland.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school in Gary in...
Emerson.
Emerson, yeah. Well, Emerson is the high school, but Emerson School but also Catholic schools, you know, they always had the religious schools.
Were you married before the beginning of the war?
No.
Okay. What were your memories of Pearl Harbor? What were your memories of Pearl Harbor?
It seemed like it was a disaster that could have been avoided if they would have been more alert. And I had a friend that was in the Navy and lived close by us that was lost in action there. And I don't know, I think... They could have done a better job at Pearl Harbor than they did if they were more alert and more so forth.
Well, you're only 17, right?
Yeah, right.
Pearl Harbor. So you were just a kid.
Right. Okay.
Did you volunteer for service?
No, I was drafted.
Okay. And which year were you drafted?
In...
42?
About 42, I believe.
Can you describe the day that you signed up? Or that you were inducted?
Well, I was inducted. I couldn't describe the day, no. I mean, you were drafted, you were called in, and they took your medical examination of you, and sent you off. That was it.
So how did you get to be in the Army Air Corps? Why didn't you just go in the Army?
The reason they got me into the Air Corps because I was flying at 17 from an airfield in Gary at 61st Broadway. And they found out I was flying. I showed them my book that I had flying hours in there. They suggested I go to the Air Force. And their training was over in... Miami Beach, in Miami.
Can you describe your training in Miami for us?
Yes, it was regular routine military training to start with, and it was. You lived in hotels actually. Lived in the Cadillac Hotel in Miami Beach, but when you lived there, they were very, very precise in having it very, very clean, and. If you messed up, you paid for it. I mean, they set you out there with a scrub brush, a toothbrush and a cup with soap, and you're done the hotel lobby for punishment.
Was that your first time in Miami?
That was the first time I was in Miami, yes.
What were your impressions of Miami like?
Miami? It's great. It was a beautiful place, especially when you come from like... Indiana, and it was in the wintertime. What would you think?
Did you specialize in any particular field in training?
Yes, I was. Went to mechanic school in Goldsboro, North Carolina, and it took several months of training there, and then they sent me to gunnery school, and that was back into Miami again. Where they had the gunnery school and that. And after that, they sent me to California.
And what kind of training did you do in California?
That was in Douglas Aircraft Company in A-20 aircraft, civilian aircraft. It was a civilian, but it was civilian instructors in Miami, I mean in California.
Where did you stay when you were in California?
Right at Douglas Aircraft. They had facilities for the Army personnel, and you had to stay with the plane for the entire time. I think it took 2 weeks to have the plane completely from the time it was a piece of sheet metal and became actually an aircraft. So you stayed with that plane every day, just like the factory workers, and studied the ship as you were going along.
When did you what did you do on leave?
On leave?
Yeah.
Well, they had the Hollywood Canteen over in the, we were there, and we take in California, and in that area, it's free. Yeah, we had a good time. There was only several days, but that you could be released. Otherwise, you were in classes.
Did a feeling of camaraderie develop among the trainees?
Basically, few, not too many. We were too busy trying to grasp what they were trying to show you. You were a young fella, and here it is. It's a whole big aircraft that you're trying to study. And they show you the electrical system, the hydraulic system, and everything that's on that aircraft. The engines. And, of course, I was in mechanic school before that. And it was a great aircraft at the time. I don't know if you knew Wrong Way Corrigan. No. He was one of the fellows that was supposed to fly to New York, and he flew to Ireland. and he was one of the pilots that flew that plane, one of those planes, and they had to put the armament on. They didn't put the armament at the factory. They had to go into a base in California where they put the armament and the bulletproof glass and well, never mind the bulletproof glass, but it was there. Everything, the guns and the ammunition. But of course, that aircraft originally was made for a bombardier. And then they converted it and put four 50 caliber machine guns in the nose instead of removed the bombardier. And the plane had two nacelles, which are on the side of the gun, which had six forward 50 calibers. That's a lot of guns.
Did you feel prepared for war?
As much as I could figure out, because I wasn't in the war at the time. I just was going through training of mechanics, and we went through gunnery school and then through the aircraft. And then they sent us to Florence, South Carolina, and we had training on the original airplanes that came there. And we picked up our pilot, the original pilot, we flew all the way to England with. So we had him at the time.
Did you stop anywhere between Florence, South Carolina, and England?
We stopped in Fort Dix, New Jersey to refuel before we went to Goose Bay, Labrador.
What was Goose Bay like?
Pardon?
What was Goose Bay like?
Well, when we landed, did you ever see a... The buildings, your hotel buildings, that's how high the snow was out there, just off the airfield. And there was no refrigeration there because all the food was stored in caves. It's cold in those caves. And we stayed there until we were ready to fly across to Greenland. And from Greenland, well, we didn't go to Greenland right away. Because you have to set that plane up in the morning because the temperature was so low that you had to prepare it in the evening by pumping gas into it to the congealed oil so it wouldn't congeal totally. So it would be, and even after After that, you had to get the temperature from the tower to find out what the temperature was, and you'd set the amount of fuel that you want in that engines, both engines, before you can leave. And then in the morning, you had to come back with a Jeep, which had a heater on there, and two of us would have to put a canvas over each engine and start this heating unit so we could heat the engines up so they're ready for flight.
So you were with your pilot, the pilot. And you went from Carolinas.
He went from Carolina. Yeah.
That was the pilot that you eventually went into contact with.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we went with that pilot, and we gave from.
You were up in Greenland.
Greenland. Yeah, we were flying to Greenland, and as we got up to Greenland, we got around 80 miles when we were going over the water, and we went over into Greenland. We got 80 miles off the coast, and they called us by radio and says, "You can't land here." Now, we're only 80 miles from landing, but so we had to turn around. The only reason we could fly that far, because the range of the aircraft is only 1,000 miles. We had auxiliary 400-gallon tanks underneath the bomb bay outside so that we hooked it up to the pumps, the fuel pumps in the plane, so we could get our fuel from the lower tank. And by the time we came back to Goose Bay again, turned around in the middle of the Atlantic, was 20 minutes worth of fuel left in the plane. We were just lucky, that's all. Very lucky.
What time of year did you cross? What year was it? And what
month? It was late. It was cold weather. It was totally cold weather at the time. It was about December or something like that, January, right in that time. It was, weather was cold. And the reason we couldn't land in Greenland is because they only had one runway, and it was all made out of iron mat, like a mat. Mm-hmm. And it was like about a mile and a half long and between two 11,000-foot mountains. And you had to come through the bay to make this landing. And the reason they told us to return, because the field was getting 150-mile-an-hour winds there, so we couldn't possibly land it.
Did you have problems with icing?
Icing? No, we didn't have. We had de-icers on the ship. De-icers on that, and you have a pedostatic tube, which gives you the airspeed. It has a de-icer in there, and the pilot was an excellent pilot, but not because he got trained in the U.S., because he was a pilot before he was trained.
Is a commercial pilot?
No, no. He was a bush pilot.
Okay.
But he was good. He was excellent flying. Never seen a pilot fly that good.
When did you arrive in England?
From Greenland, we went to Iceland and in Reykjavik, and from Iceland to Prestwick, Scotland, and from Prestwick, Scotland to the Isles of Wight in southern England, and we left our ship there. It's just a hop across each area. And refuel.
What was England like?
Pardon?
What was England like? What was England like?
England was already involved in the war.
Oh yeah, England was in the war. Oh definitely. Oh absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, we when we landed, they took our ships and took us to our base over I'm getting a little
Sure.
To our base in England there. And we flew from there.
Was that Braintree?
Braintree.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and flew from there. Yeah. All our missions were flown from there. And of course, on our seventh mission, we had one engine shot out and come in on one engine. And as you come into England at that time, because the Germans would take and convert some of the ships that were shot down, they would convert them to get into our squadrons as they were coming back into England. So there was a signal that they used every 2 hours, the different color flares that they shot in the air. It would be a green, green, blue, green, red, blue. You know, every 2 hours there would be a different signal. So as we were coming back with one engine shot out, we'd lost our squadron, and we're coming back on our own. And we're dumping all our stuff to make our ship light. As we come back, the British fired a volley across our bow. We forgot to give them the signal, because usually the lead ship shoots the signal out to show that the squadron is coming through. And they couldn't fall in unless they, you know, somebody would see an enemy if some other ship fall in into the squadron. Anyway, when we got through, we landed, and we were short on fuel. We landed on in England there, and they refused to give us fuel. We had to argue with them to get the fuel that we were giving them.
So wasn't there radio contact as you were coming in with one engine?
Yeah, there's radio contact.
They just didn't believe.
Radio contact. Do you speak English? Yeah, good. Then you could make radio contact with them. There was it was the signals that really counted. You know, the ones that they shoot the flares with.
So they didn't believe any radio contact.
No, because hey, they could tell us that they're friendlies, and we had one engine shot out. So we made it on our seventh. And we used to, the Brest Peninsula, we flew to Brest Peninsula, which is when the Germans took France over. That was the base out there where the Germans took their submarines and put it into the Atlantic closer so they could torpedo their ships. Because otherwise they'd have to go to Kiel Canal in Germany, which is where the subs were. So instead of going through all that Kiel Canal, they would be based over in France. And we were what we had was anti-personnel bombs at the time, because the Germans were in control of that area. And anti-personnel bombs are maybe about 30 pounds or maybe 35, depending on the weight. You don't weigh them until, but they're in a cluster. And there's like 35 in a cluster. You got two clusters and 32 aircraft. And when you come close with the anti-personnel bombs, naturally they fire upon you, but we can't go over 12,000 feet because we have no oxygen. Those planes did not have oxygen, you know, masks and that. So we had to stay within 11,000 feet. And as we got there and opened our bomb bay doors, two clusters fall out, and at 32 feet exactly when they drop, they open up. And each one has like 30 to 35 of these anti-personnel bombs, and they're floating through the air. And so the anti-personnel that are shooting don't shoot you anymore because they're hiding. And up above us at 25,000 feet are B-17 with 2,000 pound bombs at Brest. So we get back, and Germans were pretty clever. We'd go in, they'd let us go into a certain place. We'd have 32 aircraft go in, no opposition. Coming out, we lost half the squadron because they would put their mobile anti-aircraft guns in that right where we came in, because they figured we would come out the same way. So they had us in a ringer there. And I had 18 missions, and we got shot down on the 18th mission over between Belgium and France. And we bailed out, naturally. You could hear when the plane is hit, I think the whole front end, as I was out in the parachute, I could see the front end of the ship was all gone. And the pilots on the front end of the ship.
Now that's the pilot that you trained with.
That's the pilot we trained with, yes. And we bailed out. It was just me and the turret gunner. My job was, I had a 50 caliber machine gun in case the Germans would come up on you and they would stall out and shoot that cannon in that pursuit ship that they had. And it's 20 millimeter. And if they stall out, they would be almost motionless, because that's the way they would have to get us, because they're so much faster than we were. And so I would put the 50 caliber machine gun. My job was just to nail his head as it goes. But also, as we were bombing, I had to take pictures in the open hatches. Not like today where the cameras come on automatically and stuff. I had to get out there and lay down and take pictures where they were bombing, where the bombing were falling. That was my job, too, besides being an engineer on the ship, which I had to take care of all the gas tanks. Like on the seventh mission, I had to transfer the fuel from the engine that was running. I mean, the engine that was off to running to the engine that was running, so that we could use up the fuel in that wing that was lowered because of its missing engine. The engine was wrecked by flak. So, when we got shot down, we bailed out. Me and my buddy bailed out. We could see the ship, and we could feel the concussion. As it hit the ground, we don't know whether it was just the bombs that hit or whether the plane, because it was loaded with fuel too, and it exploded. And that was right between, say, the French and Belgian border.
So you had there were still bombs on board the plane?
Oh, yeah. There were still 500-pound bombs on the ship. And we got down. As I got down, I hit the ground. My first thing was, cover your parachute in case they have hounds or something that they could trust, you know, because you have harnesses. They could smell that and know from that, if they get that, to track you down. So what I did is took my helmet and I dug the ground up there so I could cover my parachute and put leaves and brush over the top of it. And here comes a farmer running. I don't know, he's French. I guess he was French, and he come by with his pitchforks, and I says, "Je suis Américain." "Oh, American!" He says, "Come on." He's taking me into his kitchen. He's bringing out the wine, the bread, the food. I'm just down, shot down. and I'm telling them the Bosch, which is the Germans, are going to try to pick me up. I have to have a hiding place. And he's showing me the barn with the hay and that. And I says, "No, the Bosch has, you know, stilettos that big that they can get to it." So when we decided, we found a place, was a pile of, you know, they burn wood. And they piles of wood, and that's all, because that's for winter and that. Me and him dug around there, and I got under the wood. Of course, I was only 150 pounds at the time. And got under the wood, and then he covered it up and put it just like it wasn't there. I could hear the half tracks, and I could hear the motorcycles of the Germans going there. And they were around the area. You can hear them. They had an idea that we're close. They didn't even get my buddy. I don't know how he made it, but He got out. We got together after nightfall and stuff, you know. After nightfall, we got up, and I could hear the French talking out there and telling me to come out. And they dug out and got me out, and we ran through fields and through barbed wire fences, even, actually got hung up a few times on them, and got to this big place. It was like a low form barn for a long distance. Maybe I'd say that thing was maybe about 40 or 50 feet long in length, maybe 60. And all you could see is the light on the other side. And as you walked through this barn and got on the other side, then you could turn around and look, and on each side as you were passing by, they had the French forces of interior with guns waiting to see if you were some enemy that's trying to penetrate their organization. That's what they were worried about too. So what they did, they told me to strip down, they checked my boots to make sure that they were American shoes and American equipment. they tied it all up in a string, and they took to a dry well, about 80-foot dry well, and they threw it in there. And they just gave me French clothes. I had my dog tags, but I was in French clothes. And, you know, their shirts and coats are about this big because they're smaller people. And then, yeah, then they took us down the road and different homes. We had to go from different homes. In fact, you go into one home, and there would be a mirror that you look at. You know, it wasn't a very big mirror, but it was tall. You push it on the side. There's a tunnel. And you walk down that tunnel. And you're under the house, outside, for a distance. Whereas if the enemy surrounded the house, you would be behind the enemy. And there's bushes, and you'd come up in between the bushes. You would be behind them. So you have a chance to escape. And we went from one house to another like that, all the way. Got to this one house. It was in, and this is, our armies are coming in that area where they were coming toward the Belgian. They were actually in more or less the Belgian and French border. They were almost in. And they took us to this place, and we stayed in this home. I particularly, I remember, because I'm sitting at a window on a chair just about almost like this, except it was, you know, regular square chair. Somebody knocking at the window. Look, it's a German soldier. And he's coming to the door. Of course, they go to the door and ask him what they want, what he wanted. And he says he wanted eggs. If they could sell him some eggs. They had chickens all over the place. He says, no eggs. No, he didn't do anything. He just walked away. They wouldn't sell them. But see, during the night, these same people, the Lancasters that the British sent over in the night, they would drop them. Ammunition, hand grenades, anything you wanted. They dropped them all kind of ammunition. Anything you could think of. In fact, they gave me a Sten gun, which is one of those that they use, the British use in the desert, which has a tripod on it. And they says, put it together, because they showed me the stuff, and I had to clean it like with Cosmoline. But this had like a looked like vinegar or something, and you had to clean the grease off of it because it was all packed so it doesn't rust. And put it together was very simple. And I don't know, you know, they wanted one there, but they're not supposed to have. If they had caught them with guns in the house, they would execute the whole family. So they had to cover everything and put it in on the ground somewhere else so that they could find it, you know, and get it. In fact, this one guy had a box of hand grenades, and he pulls a hand grenade out to me, and he goes and he pulls the pin on it. And the pin flips, and then he tosses it to me. And, you know, if you know French homes, they only have doors and windows one side. Other sides are solid. The back is solid. The sides are solid. And I'm standing by a window. He tosses to me. I'm ready to throw it out. I said, well, this guy must be crazy, because the distance is no further than her. You know, a hand grenade can go off. It'll kill everybody in the doggone thing from the fragments. So he tosses it to me. Then he starts to laugh. And I go over there and look, and he took the fuse out. playing around. That was him playing around. So I threw it back to him out there, and he found the pin. He put it back on. He put the hand grenade, but they had to go bury him, see, because they can't be caught in the house. And one day when the Germans were moving, and we were in this house, and it was close where our forces were moving, they had the German army personnel asked if they could stay in a house and cook their food. Now, they brought their own food, whether it was pig knuckles or whatever, and their own bread, which looked like it had pieces of wood in it, but it's probably rye that they don't process it right good or something. And they said, oh, yeah, now we were in the basement, and they had vats in the basement, you know, the French. is, oh, not quite as high as this, but I mean, the basements were low and then had water running and the vats were huge. And the Germans would had their food. They weren't searching the house. They just wanted to eat and cook their food. And that, well, the French wanted to make it nice for them, so they took some wine and brought it up to them, and they were happy as larks. Well, you know, soldiers having wine during that time, they were happy as larks. And they left after they had the food and cooked it. And that.
But you're downstairs.
We're downstairs hiding in the straw where the vats are. And he brought that stuff up, and they just took off like that. So a couple of days later, I'm walking around in the in French clothes out there, and here comes a Jeep, U.S. Jeep. And I salute the officer, because I'm a staff sergeant at the time, and he's a lieutenant, and it's got a machine gun on top, and the chauffeur in that, a chauffeur and a lieutenant. I tell him I show him my dog tags, and he says, where are you from? I says, I'm from the 9th Air Force, and I was shot down. He says, oh, okay. I says, I've got a buddy out there, too. And, of course, they drove up, and but the Germans were already moved up quite a bit. And this was a tank outfit called Notorious. Now, I don't know what number or anything, but that's what they were called, Notorious. And as far as the food that the French had, was better than what we had. We had meat and beans and vegetable hash in cans. If you ever have that, I got news for you. You get tired of it. Hardtack. And they made us eggs, because they had chickens. We had chickens. That we had good food with them. They gave us excellent food. And they even wanted us to go with them, because they used to go scouting out into the fields, into the taverns and that. You know, they would go out by the taverns. They already dig a hole down in the ground, and they would let a girl go into the tavern and sashay around, you know, and that. And this guy thinks, well, here's my girlfriend, you know, and they're going on the bicycles, and they go down the road a ways, and she's leading naturally, and going down there, and guess what? She's leading right to the French FFE, the French Forces of Interior, which are waiting for him. And the reason for that is, you know, the Germans have boots that are made of leather, belts are made of leather, and where do you think the French were getting their leather for their shoes? Off the French soldiers that they nailed and they buried.
I mean, the German soldiers.
Yeah, German soldiers, yes. They buried the German soldiers there. And they asked us if we want to go and partake into the camaraderie of getting these Germans out. No, our job is to return to the, you know, to the Air Force. And that's what we were intended to do.
So the Jeep pulls up, and that, they were not looking for you and any shot down pilots or plane crew. They happened upon you by accident.
Yep. As I was walking, yeah. As I was walking, this Jeep came by, and this lieutenant, we got onto the Jeep, told him about my buddy there, and he went and picked him up. And, the day before that, maybe a couple of days before that, the Germans were really scrambling and moving fast. And our planes were flying maybe, I'd say, a little above treetop level, and they never seen the tanks. They never seen that, because they were excellent in camouflage. You'd think that tank or that truck was just a tree, the way they camouflaged it. It was excellent in camouflage. And when we left the place, well, naturally, it got us to a base where they had captured some German soldiers, and they told us we can ride back with them, which they were going to, where was that? Versailles. That was number one. That was number one prison camp. So they got all the soldiers on the thing. They all had to stand up on the truck. They couldn't sit down. There was a guy with a machine gun sitting, and the other guy had one, and he was the driver. And they had a guard in the back with a single rifle who handed the gun to the German. Now, and he don't want to get into the army and get to the war. He wants to get out of the... He's better alive than being dead. So this guy, we were sitting on two, I think, ration boxes that they had for the drivers, because the Germans didn't get any rations. They would stop at different places sometime to feed them. And they would go by apple trees, let them get apples and stuff like that, and give them a break, you know, to take a healthy one, healthy break. And, of course, they would only let them go so far, and they'd be standing with two submachine guns, and nobody would try to run. They all got back on there. On top of the truck was a 50 caliber machine gun, but the ammunition was down in the bottom. They were playing with it, the Germans. But what can they do with a piece of iron that doesn't work? Anyway, so we rode all the way in, and in fact, we hit one town that we seen out there, and they had some kind of a going on, which the German planes were coming and bombing a small town, but we were at a distance away from it, and our anti-aircraft was trying to get them. And have I ever seen any aircraft guns that were so bad that they couldn't hit, you know what, in the butt? That was ours. Because the German planes came right by and bombed that little town, no problem. Not one came down because they couldn't hit him even. And so we kept going on until we got into Versailles. And this was number one camp, and they had a big camp. In fact, all soldiers were in there. The officers had their own place. And then they had civilians. Now, a lot of the officers would take and change into civilian clothes too, German officers, before they'd been captured. So what they did, they had to check all the civilian personnel they had, because they had civilian personnel do the work. That's who done all the work for the German army and everything. So they had to check through them. And guess what they had to eat there? Meat and beans and vegetable hash. Piles of it. I mean, it was so high. It was just like a little mountain. And the Germans ate the same food as we did. Only thing is, they had a water wagon, the old French water wagon. If you ever see them in the movies, where they're made out of wood and they're leaking on a side, they would drive them into the compound, and all the Germans would come with their cups and get the water. And the compound was all barbed wire all the way around. They had one guy walk this way, and I mean, it was like, oh man, about six blocks. And then they had to walk this way, and then they met. There's one walking this way, they met. But of course, they had two machine guns on top, and just the guards walking back and forth. And the prisoners didn't want to go nowhere. They want to be repatriated, whatever. So we got out of there, and we got into a Jeep, and we went into Paris. And there was still some fighting in Paris as we got in there. And we went to Hotel Maurice in Paris. And that's where the commanding general that Hitler put in there to control Paris. He was the head over all that. He had every bridge in France, in Paris, set up to be blown. Every one. But he had to give the word. And he didn't want to. So when they captured him, he didn't give the word. So they cleaned up the stuff from under the bridges, and they didn't explode or nothing.
So when you go into Paris, are you an armed soldier now?
No, we're on a Jeep. We're soldiers, but we haven't got any. Well, the reason they took us to Paris is that's where they flew us from Paris back to London, because they had to go to the airfields. So this hotel is so fabulous. The doors to the restaurant or whatever it is were so huge. Took two guys on each door to pull it open, and we says, "Oh, we're going to have some good meals," you know. And they bring it out,
And they got these big silver trays, big ones like that. Now, you could get wine, but you had to give them 2 francs, which is almost nothing. And they gave these big things with beautiful silver. They opened it up. Guess what they had? Meat and beans and vegetable hash, because the Germans have taken all the food out of Paris with them when they left. So that's all we had there. So, and they got the general. They got the general officially. They were throwing helmets from about the 3rd or 5th floor out of the hotel onto the in the hallway, you know, because they had their equipment laying there. They ran without their equipment and everything after that. So they had to clean. We would help them clean it up too. And as we were there, then they called us to go to the airfield, maybe about a day later. And they set up the transport ships. And as they had the transport ships, they were American. American transport ships. On them ships, they had a thing that says, Americans first, you know, that they wanted to put on. Second was Canadians. German prisoners, they had colonels and majors and stuff like that they wanted in London to interrogate. And I'm sitting right next to a colonel, a German colonel, as I'm flying back back to London. And the British soldiers, or whoever they were, the officers, they were last. All were they ticked. And we're go flying to London from Paris. But that's how it was. That's how they set it up. Americans first, Canadians, German prisoners, then the British. It was funny, but because we laughed about it, but they didn't think it was funny. And we landed in London, and they sent us to our outfit, which knew it. And we were processed at our base and get our gear, which was what was left, whoever didn't take it. And some of it was left in the quartermaster corps someplace in a corner. It had all our names and tags. Anyway, we got there, and they says, you guys can't. I says, when are we going to get to our squadron, you know, because we were at Braintree. And he says, you can't go. He says, you were in civilian clothes. I says, yeah, but we had our dog tags. He says, don't make any difference. He says, you'd be shot as a spy. So we had to get our stuff and gear, and then they took us to Hollywood, Wales. And you don't, it isn't spelled like Hollywood up here. Hollywood, Wales, and we got on transports, flying across the ocean. We got to, what was that island, Wayne?
The Canaries?
Huh?
No, you're talking about...
In the Atlantic, off the African coast.
Oh, that's the Canaries.
Yeah.
Canary Islands. We landed at the Canary Islands. They got refueled, the plane. Guess who was refueling the planes? German prisoners. Only thing is, when the plane took off, the caps on top of the planes, or the gas was coming, flowing up. They took off and they had to land. We're lucky it didn't blow up. It landed, and then they refueled it again and put the caps, and we were headed for Newfoundland. Stevensville, Newfoundland was our... We were in the Atlantic, got a storm. Somehow the storm tore up the antennas on the plane, you know, those older planes. We had to use a trailing antenna that drops off and it trails, and then we get contact, and they says, you can't go... Well, we were actually going to go to Bangor, Maine, so we had to transfer to Stevensville, Newfoundland, so that because of the storm. And we stayed there and then went to Bangor, Maine, and then we were in the States. And then they processed us, and then we went to New York, where they sent us all the way to Illinois into the hospitals, check us over, stuff like that. And they found out I was missing in action. And he says, well, you get 2 weeks vacation, 2 weeks furlough at home. Because my mom got the mail, I mean the telegram, saying I was missing in action.
Which are right there.
And so we We stayed 2 weeks, and then I had to hit the train, and we went all the way to, where was that in? John Wayne Airport, Southern.
Santa Ana.
Yeah, in Florida.
No, in California.
California.
I mean California, in California. They went to California there, and they processed us, knowing where they want us to go, and you had to be checked over there again. And they found out, well, they wanted to put me, first of all, on B-29s in Texas. I says, this little plane had enough trouble with it. Why go on B-29s? So the doc decided I wasn't quite there. So shipped me over to Spokane, Washington, where they had medical units there and everything. And I stayed in Spokane, Washington till the end of the war. And because I had time overseas and so much time in the Army, you get priority being released. People that were overseas either on either side, Pacific or Atlantic, and they were in that process, they got first choice of getting up. The other guys had to stay there right after the war was over to do the cleaning up and doing all the West, what the Army wants. And I got home. And that was it.
Well, let's do the homecoming then.
Yeah,
because that seems to be kind of where we are. Because we've talked about some of this other stuff about the end of the war, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is, you know, he's already home, and that the Pacific is still going on, and so we talked about that earlier, and what my dad said was, you know, he was just glad to be home. He was glad the war was over for him, and wasn't really paying much attention to what's going on in the Pacific. I mean, after that, your focus is now I'm home and I'm safe. So how about go on with the homecoming instance?
Can you describe your reunion with family members and friends?
Oh yeah, my mother was jumping all over me, just loving my dad, my mother, my grandmother, grandfather, and my uncle, aunts. They were glad to see me. And, they were... Well, see, my mom worked in a factory, in a steel factory, and so did my dad during the war. They both worked in the steel factories over there. And I'm home, great.
Did you get married after the war?
Yes, after the war.
Where did you meet your wife?
Oh, what was it? Maybe about 2 years, about two and a half years after the war.
He didn't
hear you. Where did you meet your wife? Where?
Oh, in Gary.
In Gary.
Right.
Wayne mentioned that there was a story about a wedding dress being made out of a parachute. Is that...
A what?
A wedding dress was made out of a parachute.
I brought my barracks bags, and I brought my parachute bag too. They didn't want it, so I brought the parachute bag and opened it up, and there was a big parachute. They made a wedding dress out of it. You know, you give it to the tailor, to whoever the ladies take care of it. They do a good, beautiful job. Yeah. Made it right out of the parachute itself. Because you got your gear. They didn't care. You didn't need the gear anymore. Because you had your own. They always had your own, and you had to have it packed, and they had specialists doing the packing on the racks where they packed the parachutes, and they just made them just right down to the size where you could put it in the bag. They were like that. And you had a choice while you were flying. You had a choice of parachutes that you wanted. You could either use the British, you can use the back chute or the seat chute, whatever chute you wanted. Going over the channel, as we were all the time, you know, from England, well, the British chute was the most feasible one because it has a control here. See, ours, we'd have to unbuckle here and hold our hands like this to unbuckle this one when we hit the water. Otherwise, you'll drown because it'll drag you down. And theirs, all you have to do is click it in one position. And once you hit the water, all you have to do is this, and the harness fell off of you. In fact, their boots were a little different than ours. They were all furry and up to here. Be nice and warm. We got GI shoes. you had a choice of what you wanted at certain times. Not too many, but if you want like the parachutes, and or if you wanted a different type of jacket, you know, that. But basically our jacket was a lot better than theirs, heavier, especially the flying jackets. You don't see those. I even didn't see them after the war, because somebody bought those up because they were really heavy, good jackets.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to relate your experiences of the war to those that remained at home?
No, when they asked questions, I answered them. I mean, to the best of my ability. Right now, at 85 years of age, I'm kind of it's kind of difficult for me to sometimes to remember the places that I was in. And then it gets a little hairy, because you try to, the bad places you don't want to remember, and the good places, yeah. Oh, I forgot to tell you, went to gunnery school too, over in Florida on the Gulf Coast. We went to gunnery school on the Gulf Coast out there, and they had these sleeves, what they have, a sleeve and a plane pulling it, and the different guys are on a machine gun. The plane is gone, there's one gunner in the back, and he's firing bullets there. The bullets are have either red, blue, or green, whatever he has in there, you know, on the gun, and you fire at the sleeve. But the plane is way out that way, and just the sleeve is floating along, and see if you can hit, you know, doing that. Those are exercises for gunnery. In fact, one guy was on a plane out there, and they told him he was firing, and his gun jammed. And the pilot says, hit the chute. What he meant was, because these were 30 caliber guns, and the shells shouldn't fall inside the plane. They have to fall in the bag, because with the rudders and that, if those shells get in there, that would be difficult for the pilot, because he sometimes it'd make it difficult for him to land. What he meant was the chute where the shells go, because sometimes they fall this way. And they kind of jam up in there. And if you hit it, it goes down into the chute. This guy took, and he bailed out in the Gulf. Because he said, hit the chute. That's what he figured, hit the chute. So he bailed out in the Gulf, and had to send a boat out there to pick him up in the middle of the Gulf. Oh.
Were you part of any celebrations or parades upon your return?
No. None. You mean after the war? No. Absolutely not.
Did you receive any medals, awards, or honors for your
service? Well, I got raised in rank because I'd done what was supposed to return. You know, you're not supposed to be a prisoner if you're going to return. I was a staff sergeant. They made me tech. Well, I got it wasn't a medal, but it was a pin that, if I can only remember what the name of it was for those that got out of enemy country without being captured. But of course, that wasn't all to us doing. It was the French Forces of Interior that helped us. And they were excellent in knowing what to do, when to do, because they were they knew the enemy. They were living there with them. Like I says, they were nice to the enemy, and the enemy wasn't, what we seen, they were pleasant to them. They didn't force them into anything or nothing. But if they found anything, like ammunition or guns or stuff like that in the farmers, you know, in the farms, in the farm itself, anywhere, that's why they buried it way out in the fields.
like I said, the Lancasters would parachute these things down to the French forces of interior. So they had as much ammunition, I think, as the Germans did. They had hand grenades, guns, machine guns, and they were great. And the people really were nice about, you know, helping us too. They were excellent people. They played with us, like I told you. They liked to horse around. And of course, that's usual, you know, with all the sorrow and stuff. Now, they would go to work at 5 a.m. And then they'd come back. Their main meal was at lunchtime, 12, 1 o'clock. That's their main meal out there. They ate their main meal. For supper, they had bread and chocolate that was sent by the planes. But when they loaded, you know, these planes and they dropped food and ammunition, they used chocolate and put it on bread, and that was their supper. That's how they had their supper. Their main meal was when they had to go back to work that food off that they ate at 12, 1 o'clock. That's why they never got fat.
How had the country changed as a result of the war?
How did the country change? Well, I think it didn't change too much. They're back in wars again. And how many since then? Different ones. You know, I mean, I couldn't tell you how it changed, but not for the better.
Did you go back to work or school? No. After the war?
I went back to work, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where did you work?
I worked at first in the screw and bolt works. That was steel works where my mom and dad worked. They got me a job there. And I worked there for a few years. Oh, 4 or 5 years, something like that. And then I got a chance on the fire department. And I spent... from about, I think I was like, what, about 32 or 33 years on the fire department. I retired at 70, 40 years on the fire department. And the reason I stayed that long is because if you stay longer, your pension is better.
That's the City of Gary Fire Department.
Okay. Yeah, your pension is better. And not only that, it's also that you can't keep up with the younger guys. You know, the firemen have to be younger guys that... Once you get into certain ages, you know, into the 50s and 60s, you haven't got what they've got. So the younger fellas, and so they give you a choice. You can ride with the medics, you could be a fire prevention bureau, you could be a mechanic, or you can be a dispatcher. I took dispatch. So I stayed in dispatch, and I made assistant chief of dispatch. And I had personnel that were very good in dispatching. Some were I had to get rid of.
Did you take advantage of the GI Bill?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. My three sons went to Indiana University and for 4 years, and they graduated. There's my son there. And Bruce, who has passed away now, he was an attorney, and he worked for... Thomas, Supreme Court Justice Thomas?
Yeah.
He was his boss at the time, and he was an attorney for the government.
Justice.
And then he drowned. Where was that?
In North Carolina.
North Carolina. Yeah. He drowned in the ocean. He was swimming in September in the ocean, and... He drowned. And Wayne here graduated from Indiana University. Got his, did you get?
I got in education.
You got education, and he's now, what are you now?
I've been a principal, I've been a school superintendent, I've been a classroom teacher, and I'm back to a principal again. And then Larry,
yeah. Larry's in
business. He went to school of business.
Yeah, business. He's an insurance golfer, mostly.
Finance guy.
Finance.
stuff like that. Golf. Oh, racquetball, tennis. He's got all those good things in his favor. He's been a champion in his area for 4 times in golf. He won the Indiana racquetball.
Oh yeah, he's been
2 or 3 times, and they go in age brackets. Yeah. And he's now in the 50 age bracket. He's Indiana number 1 champ. And boy, I'm telling you, if you saw a guy that goes into sports, he's it. He loves it. Sports is favorite thing.
Did you remain active in veterans associations?
Yeah, American Legion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. Yeah. For a period of time, till they got greedy and start charging $35. I mean, that's uncalled for. Really?
Did you maintain contact with those you met during the war?
No, but I made contact with people in the organization. Yeah. In the
410th.
Pardon?
It's the 410th bomb.
Yeah, 410th bomb group. Yeah, the 410th bomb. I'm in the 410th bomb group with other personnel from different. See. From different sections of that are in there, and they have certain places you can go to that they make connections and stuff like that.
How did your wartime experience change your perceptions of other wars?
This is an opinion question.
Bob. Oh, that's an opinion?
Mm-hmm.
You wonder why should there be other wars after that? Why?
Yes.
If they can't control that.
Good answer.
God bless him. I can't see why we should have other wars. And the one we're having now is ridiculous.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Wachowski?
Not offhand, you know. Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.